From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Illinois Public Media News and Public Affairs Director. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. Less than a year from now, Illinois voters will elect a new U.S. Senator. After 30 years in office, Dick Durbin, one of the highest-ranking Democrats, is retiring. Today, we're going to hear from three of the candidates who want to replace him, including two black women, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton and Congresswoman Robin Kelly. Both are Democratic candidates. We'll also hear from Republican Don Tracy, who is also in the race. All the candidates appeared previously on the 21st show. A third Democrat, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, has agreed to an interview but hasn't been able to schedule one yet. Let's start with Lieutenant Governor Stratton, who talked with Brian Mackey in August.
A brief biography. Juliana Wiggins was born September 8, 1965. She's the daughter of a physician and a teacher raised on the south side of Chicago. Stratton has a degree in broadcast journalism from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and a law degree from DePaul. She had a full career as a lawyer, a mediator, and administrative law judge before her first and only solo campaign when she ran for state representative in 2016. Then in her first and only term as a legislator, a wealthy political outsider named J.B. Pritzker selected her as his running mate. All right, basic question of any candidate. Why do you want to be a senator?
Well, I mean, look at what's happening in our country right now. I've been a public servant all my life. And before running for state representative, by the way, I ran for local school council at the public high school that I attended, a public high school on the south side of Chicago. And so throughout my career, I've always sought to figure out ways that I could serve my community, make life better. I had a wonderful example from my parents. As you mentioned, my mother was a public school teacher. She also taught in a community college, taught adults how to read. She taught adult literacy for people who had never learned how to read. And my dad was a community physician. He only worked at safety net hospitals on the south side, taking care of people who were underinsured or uninsured. And so that's what I grew up with, watching their example, and have always seen my role as a public servant as something that I wanted to carry out in any way that I could. But I can say that right now, with the chaos that we are seeing out of Washington, the real urgency of this particular moment, and waking up to my youngest of four daughters, who was in tears, thinking about what the future might look like, even in her young mind, I knew not exactly what the role would be at that time, but I knew that there was more to do. And I got into office because I saw a need and I knew I had to step up and meet the need. And this was another opportunity where I knew I had to do whatever I could. And I think so many ask the question of themselves, what more should I do right now to meet this moment? And for me, it was running for the United States Senate to fight for the people of Illinois and continue doing what we have done over these last 7 years as I've served as Lieutenant Governor alongside Governor J.B. Pritzker, to make sure we provide steady leadership and make people's lives better, because honestly, that is what government is supposed to do.
As a senator, part of your role would be advice and consent. Of course, that's with regard to presidential appointments. But what's an example of where you gave Governor Pritzker some advice on something on which you disagreed with him?
Oh, there's not a lot of examples of where we've disagreed, to be quite honest. I mean, we talk and we're what I would say is, first of all, we're two very different people from two different backgrounds, growing up in different circumstances. And so I would say that in general, there are times when we would discuss issues where I would come from it from a different standpoint. I mean, I think about, for example, when I ran, I called him about a year and a half ago and said, you know, we've done so much around women's reproductive freedom, for example, and protecting reproductive rights in this state. But black women are still dying three times more, you know, more than our white counterparts through pregnancy-related complications. And it was just it's those kinds of moments that I would say where my experience, my life and lived experience is able to kind of come in and say, here's something that I'm thinking about. And he said, let's do something about it. And we passed the Birth Equity Initiative, and I was grateful to be able to lead that effort for our administration and work with some incredible partners in the General Assembly. We now cover lactation consultants and doulas and midwives, whether you're covered by Medicaid or private insurance, with no copay to help save women's lives, particularly Black women who are more likely to die. So that's an example of where what I would say happens more often, which is our different life experiences might have we might see things a little differently or bring a different angle, but ultimately we can work together, hear each other out, and find whatever's best for the people that we represent.
You check a lot of boxes among traditional Democratic Party values, right? You're highly educated. I think you come across as bringing a lawyer's preparation to what you're doing here. You're a marathon runner and a triathlete. And yet, in our political environment today, it seems like, you know, social media, for example, rewards those in politics who come across as, you know, more raw, provocative. I wonder how you go about distinguishing yourself in this environment.
I think the first thing that I always kind of have at the forefront for me in distinguishing myself is being authentically me. I know what my experiences are. I know the life that I have lived growing up on the South Side of Chicago. I know what it's like to be a mother. I know what it's like, which has led me to politics, which was caring for my mother who had Alzheimer's. And caring for her in the final years of her life while also being a mom, while also working full-time and being a career woman, it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. It's also something that I'd do again in a heartbeat if I could. But I bring those stories and those experiences because those are the kinds of struggles that everyday Illinoisans have. And my goal as an authentic person, just as Juliana Stratton, not Lieutenant Governor Stratton, but Juliana Stratton, a wife and a mother, a daughter, a caregiver, that is what I try to connect with people. You know, I think there's not this formula. I don't think right now people are looking for sort of this formula. This is, you know, or boxes to check. I think people are looking for real authenticity, and they want to know that somebody is going to hear them, who knows their struggles. I'm from a family, I have to budget, and I sit out, my husband and I have to go through, hey, we have this new expense, what's gonna happen? That's what people are feeling right now, especially in this economy where so many people are looking for life to be more affordable. So I think for me, it's connecting with people, just being real and genuine, listening to them, understanding their struggles, and I think that's what people are looking for, not just someone who checks a box, not someone who just has the talking points, but somebody who can talk to them from a real space, and that's what I always try to do.
One of the issue areas I do want to get to, which is would be part of your remit as a United States Senator, is foreign affairs. It's been, we're coming up on 2 years since Israel has been carrying out military operations in Gaza after the Hamas attack there. Is what Israel is doing there a genocide?
Well, look, what we're seeing in Israel, in Gaza right now, is clearly heart-wrenching. And I say that as a mother, just to see some of the images that we are seeing. And I've made it very clear that right now, we should all be very focused on getting humanitarian aid, food, and whatever's needed. Israel should be doing that. The United States should be working on that. And it needs to happen immediately, and it needs to happen right now. We have to make sure that we continue to work and not get, you know, do anything that would jeopardize. We need to make sure that we get the hostages returned, the hostages which are still being held by Hamas. We need a ceasefire to bring peace and end the violence in that region. And we need to make sure that that peace is sustained. So that's what I want to see. And that's what I will be working for. And we cannot get it without steady leadership in Washington. And that's one of the reasons why I'm running.
There are a lot of progressive voters. We hear from them on this show who want to hear Democratic officials saying it's a genocide. How do you respond to that?
I respond in the way that I said. I don't agree. In fact, I've strongly disagreed with many of the ways that this war has been carried out by Prime Minister Netanyahu. But I also speak very clearly about what is happening with the humanitarian crisis that is happening and the need for the hostages to be returned to their families. I want to see a ceasefire. I want to see an end to this violence. But I also have to remember, as you just noted, how this all started on October 7th and the horrific terrorist attacks by Hamas and what has unfolded since. So I want to see peace. I want to see that happen. But we need something, we need the hostages to be returned as well.
There have been multiple United States Senate votes to send money to Israel, or I should say weapons to Israel, largely funding for weapons in Israel. Would you have supported those votes? Were you in the Senate at the time?
I would not have supported that vote. I don't want to do anything that could jeopardize the long-term or put at risk what I believe should be the long-term goals, which is hostages being returned to their families, a true ceasefire, and bringing peace to the region. And I cannot say that those kinds of resolutions, I don't know, that could have put all of that at risk. And that would be my concern.
The last things I want to ask you about are, there are more people who don't vote than vote, right? We talk about people who are on the left, people who are on the right. Lloyd in Danville wants to know how you can get more Illinois non-voters to actually vote.
Well,
engaged with politics, I guess, is the, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to be engaged in politics, I always say people are engaged in politics whether they know they are or not, quite frankly, just by living. But look, we have to really address what matters to people right now. And from my estimation, and as I'm running for United States Senate, there are three particular areas that I am focused on. Number one, how do we make life more affordable? When people feel like you don't care about that issue, sometimes they check out. That you can talk about all of these big issues, but what I know is what I'm feeling in my household when I'm trying to pay my bills, when I'm trying to get my kids, school supplies and their new first day of school outfit, when I go to the grocery store and I see how groceries are, the prices are rising. And remember, Donald Trump told us he was going to address all of that on day one. It has not happened. So we have to meet people where they are. Number one, how do we make life more affordable? We did that here in Illinois by raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. What that did was it lifted so many people out of poverty. People who were in low-wage jobs, $15 an hour, lifting them out of poverty. The federal minimum wage is still $7.25. I want to raise that. We have to talk about where people are. We see Donald Trump just gave tax breaks to the ultra wealthy through that so-called big, beautiful bill, as he calls it. I want to see a tax breaks for middle-class families, and I want to pay for it with those by taxing and giving a tax increase to those making $1 million or more. That's what I want to see. That helps real people with their real issues of affordability. I want to see us create more opportunities for the middle class by restoring the Department of Education. I want to make sure that we have more opportunities in trade and technical schools. I want to make sure that we invest in grants for small businesses. That's what I want to do as your next United States Senator. And I want to protect our rights and our democracy because they are under attack. I want to protect voting rights. I want to make sure that we, restore the rights of Roe versus Wade. I want to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and I want to do what I said earlier, which is pass universal health care and guarantee health care for every American. That also is going to play a big role in life being more affordable for people. Because there are people who are making a decision this very day, do I get health care or do I pay my bills? And that should not be the case. So when we can talk about the things that people really care about, what's affecting their life on a day-to-day basis, I hope people will get more engaged. But when people feel like you're sort of talking about these issues that are sort of out there and they can't see how it connects to their daily life, they're not engaged. And I want them to be. And that's why I'm talking about what matters to them. It's why I launched my Keeping It Real listening tour, that I'm going all around the state to keep it real with people and hear from them what matters. I want to take the voices of Illinoisans with me, but when people feel like you go, I want to just say this, Brian, I'm the only candidate in this race not accepting corporate PAC dollars. And I'm doing that because I don't want to represent the special interest of corporations when I get to D.C. I want to represent Illinois' working families. And that's real for me, because I know that people are feeling like people get to Washington and they forget all about me. They want my vote and then they leave and they don't pay attention to me. I've been a leader for these last 7 years and I'm going to keep doing that.
You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We're sharing excerpts of our interviews with candidates running to replace Dick Durbin in the U.S. Senate. You just heard from Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. Our second interview is with Robin Kelly, who currently represents the 2nd Congressional District of Illinois. She spoke with Brian Mackey of The 21st Show in late August.
A brief biography. Robin Lynn Kelly was born in 1956 in Harlem, New York. She's the daughter of a second-generation grocer and a postal worker. Early in life, she wanted to become a child psychologist, studied at Bradley University in Peoria. She has a bachelor's in psychology and a master's in counseling from Bradley. And in Peoria, she directed a crisis nursery. Later in life, she earned a PhD in political science from Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. Kelly has worked in municipal government in Madison, Illinois, and Cook County. She was also an Illinois state lawmaker, then worked with Alexei Janulius when he was Illinois treasurer, and won her congressional seat in a special election in 2013. The district is vast. It starts at the Museum of Science and Industry on the south side of Chicago. It stretches west to include the towns of Dwight and Pontiac along Interstate 55, and it continues south to take in Danville in east central Illinois. All right, let's start with a basic question. Why do you want to be a senator?
You know, I've worked on every level of government, as you just talked about, and 12 and a half years in Congress, and I know I'm very ready and very able to move to the next level. I've done the work. I'm doing the work. I've been an effective leader on every level. I have great relations in the House and in the Senate, and I know that I will be able to hit the ground running on day one. Trump will still be the president, and we need somebody that's ready to go immediately to not only fight. You know, fighting is one thing, but serving and getting the job done is something else.
Well, on that very point, we asked our listeners if they have questions for you. Beth in Champaign sent us a text message, wants to know how you plan to oppose President Trump and his agenda. She says that business as usual isn't working. What new ideas do you have?
Well, actually, we're opposing him now. I'm not waiting till I get to the Senate. And we are fighting with one arm tied behind our back. That's the truth. And I say I'm fighting till the next arm falls off and then I'll start kicking. And but we need partners. You know, we're pushing every amendment that we can push. We're traveling the country, letting people know exactly what's going on. Because believe it or not, you know, according to polls, if you believe it, still a lot of people don't realize the bill that was passed. So we're asking for help from human rights organizations, from individuals, from healthcare organizations, because these are healthcare will greatly be affected when this bill is implemented. So it's really informing people, communicating with people, putting up every amendment we can put up with, and still speaking to our colleagues on the other side. Because we need some brave ones, you know, to say, do you really think this is right? And we know some of them do not, but just haven't had the backbone, whatever you want to call it, you know, to do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, on that point, Danny in DeKalb wants to know how you will protect individuals, especially children, currently enrolled in Medicaid, now that the federal government has made moves to drastically cut the program, or will in the future.
Right. It hasn't been implemented yet. So what we're hoping that those who live in districts that are represented by Republicans, that they're making their voices heard. They're going to their offices. They're calling them. I know everybody can't come to D.C., but they're our partners in fighting back, because we need those partners. If, you know, let them know we vote too. We're looking at what you're doing. and that we care. But yeah, just again, I'm on the healthcare subcommittee. I was there 26 and a half hours straight and, you know, putting an amendment after amendment. We went to the rules committee and did the same thing. But the harsh reality is we don't have, you know, the votes, but we're just trying to communicate with everybody so they know, you know, what's going on.
I talk to a lot of just Democratic, you know, everyday Democrats, sure. Right? And a lot of them are pretty concerned that the party is losing younger voters. One man from Chicago singled out young Black men in particular, whom we know moved to Trump in, you know, not a majority, but in measurable numbers. What is your understanding of what's happening there?
Well, you know, on that issue, a lot of Black men did vote for Kamala. And I know we like to say, you know, what you just said, but I think it was 83 or 85%. So that's still a hefty, I would love that, you know, a hefty vote for a candidate. But I think—
But less than Black women who are like 90-something
well,
percent.
We're the 92%, yeah. You know. We're the backbone of the party. But I think that— people have to feel that we care about them and that we're listening to them and that they have a voice and that there is economic opportunity, because that's part of it, too, that, you know, people have hope and that their issues are a concern. And we just have to, you know, keep communicating in every way that we can. We learned that lesson in November that even though I love being on the radio and on TV, but not everyone gets, in fact, the majority. And young people, especially, I just spoke to a young person that goes to U of I, and he told me, I don't even have cable, and a lot of my friends get their news from other friends and what other friends post or TikTok or Instagram. So we have to be in all those spaces.
On the question of healthcare, Gina in Springfield wants to know what you believe should be done to assure good healthcare for all in Illinois and throughout the United States.
I don't mean this in a cavalier way, but whatever we decide to call it, I think there should be universal healthcare. Everyone should have healthcare. And I've always, you know, said that there's no reason in the richest country in the history of the world that everyone doesn't have quality healthcare. And if other countries can do it, we need to figure it out. You know, I look at things we all do better when we all do better. So we're all healthier when we're all healthier. We're all safer when we're all safer. So I'm on the Medicaid for all, but, you know, we have to get something passed. And so if it's not exactly called that, but as long as every single person has quality healthcare and access to healthcare.
Do you think ideally is it like a UK, Canada, you know, Nordic system or single payer, or is it, you know, expansion of Obamacare even further kind of thing?
Well, when the Affordable Care Act was passed, everyone knew that it wasn't perfect, but we've just never had the right people voting at the same time as you need to make the changes that are really needed or make the improvements. So I'm open to looking at, you know, what's the best thing to do for the people.
Yeah. We've also seen, just on sticking with domestic policy, we've seen President Trump inserting himself into major business deals between America and international companies, right? That differs from previous administrations, whether it's the Nippon-U.S. Steel mm-hmm. deal or... federal government is apparently going to take a cut of NVIDIA and AMD AI chip sales to China. What do you think about the president's approach here? Do you see value in intervening in the free market in this way?
No. I think that, you know, he's taught us things that we have to look at differently whenever we're in charge again. His fingers are just in too many pots, and sometimes not in the pots maybe they should be in and what he should be helping with. But I look at this all for selfish reasons. He's doing this for his gain or for, you know, the well-off and the well-connected, for their gain, not the gain, you know, of the American people. He made a lot of promises, you know, day one what he was going to do, and none of that has happened yet. But I think he just looks out for the few and not really for the many. And is it really helping? You know, it doesn't look like it. You know, more time will tell. But no, I think that he's out of place, very much out of place in many ways.
Hmm. All right, Joe in Charleston sent a text message, wonders what kind of federal gun policy reform would you sponsor or support? For example, keeping guns from Indiana and Wisconsin out of Chicago.
Well, when I ran for Congress, I actually ran on gun violence prevention. And the bill that we passed, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, first bill we passed in 30 years, didn't go as far as some of us wanted, but my part of the bill was the trafficking and store purchasing. That's always been my voice in Congress. Because people, when I would come back to D.C., what is going on in Chicago? What's going on? You have the toughest gun laws. And I would tell people, if no one else around us does, then it's hard for us to, you know, do what we need to do. So that's always been something I've harped on, as well as, you know, in Congress, we always, when there was a mass shooting, you know, stood up, you know, moment of silence, sat down and did nothing. And I brought the voice of, what about the everyday person that dies one by one by one, the slow motion massacre that happens across the United States? Is actually more, you know, of those people. We never, you know, talk about that. And that's what led me to being the only one of 435 for the next moment of silence. I didn't stand up. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I went, it was a California shooting, and I went to the delegation, not trying to be disrespectful, but I feel like we're being disrespectful because we don't do anything. We stand up, sit down, and the silence is deafening.
It's been going on 2 years since Hamas invaded Israel and kidnapped a few hundred people, killed more than 1,000 people, and Israel has now, 60,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. Is what's happening in Gaza a genocide?
You know, I don't know if that's my determination to make, but I stand by what I said, that the humanitarian crisis is horrible. And I would have voted with our senators, Durbin and Duckworth, and how they voted, because I think that we cannot keep this going. We cannot see starving children, starving pregnant moms, and, you know, just continue. It is truly a humanitarian crisis. And I would have, you know, like I said, voted with them. And
explain that to our listeners, because you have voted in the past for the legislation that, or the budget bills that
I have, yeah, stood with Israel. But in this moment, I cannot. And it's not, when I say can't stand with Israel, it's with Netanyahu and his regime, that it's nothing, just like people have a problem with Donald Trump, you know, but that I'm not Donald Trump and I don't agree, you know, what he does. And I've had Israelis in my office, and two of them had hostages, family members hostages, and one young lady hid under dead bodies to get out of the concert alive. And they lectured me about, don't just say because you're Palestinian, you mean Hamas, because they told me about their Palestinian friends. They want peace. Yes, the hostages need to be released, but they don't like the way he's going about doing things. And we have got to get to a two-state solution. I mean, this is just ridiculous. And we can't, I don't want to see us aid Netanyahu in further starvation of too many innocent people, for the death of too many innocent people.
One of the things I hear from people is that they feel that maybe public officials, you know, they can't relate to them, right? We've seen a number of instances. President Biden was fairly old. Senator Durbin chose to resign or to not run for reelection, but I think we'd probably be here saying, you'd be telling me how great he was if he had decided to run for reelection. So
he'd be better than what we are now.
Should there be a mandatory retirement age for members of Congress?
I don't think so. And, you know, I when I was a state rep, I met with different people that had term, well, you're not saying term limits, but term, yeah, limits, and they don't like that they did that. I've spoken to many people that regret that their state went that way. I think that it depends on the person. People love Auntie Max. I don't care what age. Maxine Waters. People love Bernie Sanders. People don't talk about his age. I think it depends. People love Nancy Pelosi. You know, I think it depends on who you're talking about.
And yet there was one of your Republican colleagues was found in a nursing home.
Well, yeah, that person should retire. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's good to have generational differences in Congress. I mean, that represents the entire United States. And I just you know, it depends on the person. I mean, I see it.
Forgive me, sir. You would be 70 when sworn into the Senate if elected. How long would you think you might serve for?
It depends on my, you know, how I feel, my health, what I think I'm, you know, contributing. I mean, we have to be honest with ourselves, too. I'm not, you know, saying that. But I know, you know, I work hard. I don't see anything stopping me, you know, from doing that. I will also always, as I do, surround myself with truth tellers.
That was Democratic Congresswoman Robin Kelly speaking with Ryan Mackey. Our interviews with U.S. Senate candidates continues with Republican Don Tracy next on Dialogue.